This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Was it a mistake for the defense to introduce the autism alleged diagnosis? Because as far as I know, we don't have any proof that that's there, that he actually has the diagnosis. I would assume if you're going to introduce it, there's got to be some medical record to back it up. Would there not? I mean, if you're going to say this out loud in court that he has autism, he's been diagnosed with autism, you can't just like self-diagnose yourself with autism. I mean, for it to be relevant. So let's assume there is an autism diagnosis somewhere in his history. Does that help or hurt it? Because to me, when I saw that, that's kind of damning. Like, this doesn't sound like it's going to help you in any way, shape, or form, unless you're simply trying to use that for the penalty phase of this to not get the death penalty because you're somehow mentally inept and you couldn't control what you were doing, which clearly is not the case. But I don't know if they thought that, I don't know what they thought with introducing this, because it doesn't necessarily lean to you're less likely to do this. To me, it leans like you might be more likely because, again, not everybody on that spectrum doesn't have empathy, but there's some that do. There's places on that spectrum where you are missing that. That's just your genetics. That's how you operate. Doesn't make you a killer. But it is a struggle for many people to try and feel that empathy when they can't. And Koberger's already shown a tendency to not have it, even wrote about not having it. So was that a wise move to add that into the lexicon here, even though the judge has ruled that autism can't be used as an aggravating factor in the death penalty?
Yeah, Tony, I think the jury's still out on that one. You know, number one, it absolutely would have to be presented by an expert who has knowledge of that diagnosis of Koberger and can substantiate that. Number two, who cares? How does that relate to the case?
Yeah.
The defense is going to have to identify some kind of specific symptoms of autism spectrum disorder that Koberger had that somehow makes it less likely he did this, or at the penalty phase makes it less likely or makes him less blameworthy for his conduct. And you know, autism spectrum disorder, my understanding is a broad panoply of different symptoms. And I just think it's a bit vague and speculative, and I don't see how it's going to give them a leg up at either phase of the game.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it would be like saying, and he loves to collect knives. Okay, like, so just so he's a collector and it just happens that he has, I mean, I'm just making that up. They're not saying that, but it was like a statement like, ooh, maybe you should have thought about that one a little bit more before you brought that into the lexicon of everything here. Koberger's family, the talk is that some may be blocked from viewing the trial until they've testified. Number one, how common is it to see a family member testify against their own son or their brother in a death penalty trial and testifying against that individual? What do you think we could see happen here? What sort of rights do they have if they do take the stand? Can they take the fifth and just not talk? Or what can they do if they're on the stand? They may want to talk.
Yeah, it's not terribly common to have a family member testify against their own family, but it certainly happens. Depends on the nature of the case. One thing is that the family member likely doesn't have much say in whether they have to testify or not. If the prosecution subpoenas them, then they will have to take that stand. Now, can they assert the fifth? Perhaps they could, but the implication from that is that there was some sort of criminal legal liability that could be attached to their responses to questions. Does that color things in an even more negative fashion for Koberger if someone gets up there and takes the fifth? Now, different judges have different policies on whether someone could take the fifth in front of a jury, but I think there are questions that to which the fifth doesn't apply. Simply questions about Koberger, about what he's like, about that might undermine the defense. Those things, it wouldn't be appropriate for a family member to say, "I plead the fifth to protect myself." Where you don't have any criminal risk when it comes to those questions.
And I guess that's kind of leads to my next question. I mean, what sort of things can the prosecutor ask the family that is going to be relevant to the case? Obviously, questions about his demeanor when he returned to Pennsylvania, questions about that car ride with the dad, things within that context of that bubble, of that time span right there. Can they also go back further? Can they go back to like childhood? Can they ask, what was he like as a kid? What sort of things did you observe back then? You know, when he was diagnosed with autism, why, you know, what were the signs that led to that? How far and how deep can they go back into the psyche, or at least the understanding and perception of the psyche from the family, beyond the scope of returning for Thanksgiving and that time window right there?
I think the general rule, and the judge is probably going to make a prudent move on this, is that any questions would have to be limited in scope to the allegations themselves and the general time frame within which it's alleged that Koberger did this. Now, Koberger could open the door, however, to prior historical information, especially if they're running some kind of, you know, he was autistic and so that's why he was stargazing or something. You know, the government could say, hey, you know, has he done this before? Can you tell us, you know, other instances where he's gone stargazing or has that never happened? And you know, So the door can be open to that kind of thing. But as a general rule, I think the judge is going to keep it pretty tight to the scope of this trial, unless that door is open.
Yeah, I mean, does the autism argument open that door to some more speculation if it's brought up? Because I know it can't be used for, you know, showing a propensity to kill or not. But it's been talked about now. Can it be brought up in that context?
You know, I think it potentially can, especially if the defense is the first to offer information mm-hmm. about autism, that can potentially open the door. And then the prosecution can elicit facts that are inconsistent with what the defense is saying. They could say, hey, look, you know, he was a PhD student, right? He was pretty, you know, articulate and on top of things mentally. And you know, there's no prior erratic behavior of him, you know, standing outside at 3 a.m. when he's 7 years old looking at the stars, right? Like, you know, it just, they can use it to try to undermine some kind of autism or mental health argument defense makes.
So what I'm wondering here is if we're going to go and ask the family to testify and we're going beyond the scope of the trip back to Pennsylvania and we go back to childhood, assuming that's when the diagnosis was made, if it was made, like why? What happened here? What was he doing that made someone, you know, look at this? The one I'll go back to is, you know, I would hear this as a kid back in Wisconsin during the Dahmer days, because Dahmer was known to have been very cruel to animals and tortured them as a child. And anytime, you know, boys are out doing things or whatever, we're like stepping on anthills or whatnot. I had my mom come because I loved like messing with the ants in our yard. I was an only child, so this is what you do in Wisconsin when you have no one around you. You mess with the anthills. So, and they didn't, my parents didn't like the ants, so I would, you know, pour water on them. My mom so lovingly would be like, it's like Jeffrey Dahmer, like he was killing animals. And I'm like, it's ants. It's like, it's ants. Like, I'll do an ant farm next if you'd like, Mom. But it, like, if there's something like that, if we find something where, and nothing is out there of this. I'm just purely speculatively saying, if there was something like that, where he was, you know, they found him torturing cats or whatever, and that's not out there. So don't anybody think I'm saying that. But if there is something like that, could that be brought into the trial of, look, he had the propensity to do this back then. We got him looked at. There turned out there was some sort of autism thing going on, an issue with empathy. Could that be brought in if it exists? Again, not saying it is, just purely speculative.
Hypothetically, if those events happen or something like that, I don't think they would see the light of the day in the courtroom during the guilt phase. Mm-hmm. I think the government would be downright silly to risk a reversal of a conviction based on, you know, prior alleged bad acts mm-hmm. with animal abuse or something,
yeah.
You know, whatever it is. And that would be foolish of them because cases are overturned on admitted admission of prior bad acts all the time.
Yeah.
During the penalty phase, gosh, there are a lot less rules and things come in. And you know, do you talk about a history of violence for the person, or are you allowed to tell the jury about that if such a history did exist? That one is questionable. It could go either way, I think. But certainly more information about prior historical stuff, including unsavory stuff, could come out at the penalty phase if we get that.
Because that's what I'm curious about, because not everything that's unsavory or bad acts necessarily means it was litigated ever or was ever in a courtroom. Sometimes it's just within the confines of a family, between those walls and what they knew about their kid growing up. And, you know, not necessarily crimes, but just there's something off here. And things like that. That's what I would be wondering, because it shows, you know, a pattern. It shows there's something way off with the autism thing. That's why I'm curious about the other thing. The big selfie, the selfie in the shower, the one we've talked about before, that it reminds me of Norman Bates and reminds me of American Psycho and Ted Bundy and a whole slew of others. The judge has not yet said if that's going to be admissible to court yet. The purpose of it is not to go down those roads. That's for us over here. It's for the bushy eyebrows, because that's the claim that one of the surviving roommates has made, that the bushy eyebrows, that's how I recognize who he was. And look, this next day in a picture, he's got the same bushy eyebrows. He can't argue that he didn't have bushy eyebrows then. Do you think this is going to get in? And if not, why?
I think it definitely comes in potentially at both phases for the reasons you said. You know, prosecution has to prove identity. They got to prove that Koberger did this. And there was that witness, the surviving roommate, who said the killer had bushy eyebrows. He has characteristically bushy eyebrows, and he had them the very next day. You know, appearances can change at trial. Things can be tempered, and person might not look exactly the same. So the prosecution is entitled to show, hey, the very next day, his appearance matched in part what the surviving witness said. And then, you know, the implications from that, especially at the death penalty phase, if he is convicted, show like a complete lack of remorse and detachment from the gravity of how heinous these acts were. And so there it could really heat up at that second phase.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.